Audiobook MP3 of this book. Surfing the Himalayas, A Spiritual Adventure, of Frederick Lentz. The following account of my Himalayan adventures is based on a series of experiences that occurred to me some time ago in Nepal. I have taken the liberty of transforming these accounts, even though they are based upon real-life occurrences, into a work of fiction. I hope that the internal and external experiences presented in the following pages both entertain and enlighten you. The following account of my Himalayan adventures is based on a series of experiences that occurred to me some time ago in Nepal. I have taken the liberty of transforming these accounts, even though they are based upon real-life occurrences, into a work of fiction. I hope that the internal and external experiences presented in the following pages both entertain and enlighten you. Chapter 1, Journey to Nepal. I have always been in love with the snow. There is something about its perfect crystal whiteness that transports me to happiness. On frozen blizzard nights, when sensible people stay safely indoors by cozy fireplaces, while their children sleep snug as bugs in a rug in warm beds, covered by blankets and fluffy down comforters, I walk alone in the wind-whipped snow, down lonely pine-trimmed lanes. My fascination began when I was a child. On cold winter mornings and frozen afternoons I would play in the snow until, red-cheeked and frozen-fingered, I was called indoors by my mother. She'd hand me hot chocolate and then dry my soaking clothes, boots and gloves by the fireplace. As soon as my clothes were dry and I had slipped them back on, I'd run back outside again to the snowy whiteness of our backyard, where I'd play happily until the sun set, and the first stars of evening began to appear. I probably would have grown up to be a doctor, as my mother wished, or gone on to law school and become an attorney, as my father advised, if, on my 7th birthday, my grandparents hadn't given me my first sled. It was a bleached oak flexible flyer with fire engine red steel runners. The words flexible flyer were proudly stenciled in big black letters, for all the world to see, across the top of its blonde oak body. I spent the better part of that winter, and many winters that followed, on top of my flexible flyer, rapidly rushing down every steep snow-covered slope I could find. There's nothing like gliding on snow. The cold wind rushes up to greet your face as you careen madly down a sharp slope. You steer with your hands and hope to gain extra speed by pressing your body as flatly as possible against your sled. Maneuvering quickly, first left and then right, I always aimed for the steepest downhill sections of the trail to gain maximum velocity. I spent many frozen afternoons perfecting my maneuvers for taking corners faster. As soon as I reached the bottom of a hill, I would immediately rush back up to the top again, laughing and dragging my sled behind me. Once there, without pausing to catch my breath, I would dive back on top of my sled and tear down the hillside again. Eventually I could sled down a slope faster than any of my friends could. It was logical, I suppose, that as I grew older I would graduate from sledding to snowboarding. Skiing was too social a sport for me. It lacked the pure intensity and grace of standing on top of a 4.5-foot-long fiberglass board while plummeting straight down mountains of snow. Having successfully snowboarded most of the higher mountains in the United States and Canada, I packed my bags and two snowboards, said goodbye to my friends and relations, and traveled by plane to Nepal, to snow surf the roof of the world. I flew on Lufthansa to Frankfurt, where I changed planes for Kathmandu. I arrived late on a cold January afternoon and, after clearing Nepalese customs, went straight to the Kathmandu Youth Hostel. The hostel was located on the eastern side of Kathmandu. It was a two-story brick and stucco building with very small windows. Inside there were cots and lots of European college students. Most of them had come to Nepal looking for enlightenment, which they hoped to find while seated at the feet of a local Buddhist monk. I answered her questions for about an hour, and then, yawning with fatigue, I excused myself. After a washing with freezing cold water, since no hot water was left, I crawled into my sleeping bag, fell asleep, and had a most unusual dream. In my dream, I was snowboarding down a gigantic mountain. The slope below me went straight down as far as I could see, I was riding on my snowboard, happily cutting in and out of the deep granular powder, when suddenly, from out of nowhere, a small, bald-headed Buddhist monk, dressed in a saffron-colored robe, appeared right in front of me. I reflexively cut my snowboard left to avoid hitting him, but he remained in front of me. Then I tried cutting right to avoid him, but he was still there. It didn't seem to make any difference which way or how I maneuvered my snowboard, he always managed to stay several feet ahead of me. Accepting the fact that I couldn't get away from him, for some reason it is easy to accept the most extraordinary situations as ordinary in dreams, I found myself staring at him. A soft, golden, phosphorescent light emanated from and surrounded his entire body. I found my gaze irresistible, which was creased and wrinkled with many fine lines of age. As I stared at him, the bald-headed monk looked back impassively at me. Then, quite unexpectedly, he winked, and disappeared as quickly as he had appeared. Looking ahead, I saw that I was rapidly snowboarding toward the edge of a cliff. Before I could stop myself, I shot over the cliff's edge and, in a nightmarish turn of events, found myself plummeting straight down into an endless chasm of snow. I was about to start yelling when I heard a voice coming from my right side. In a firm, male tone, it said, "Don't give up. Fly. Use your mind, you can do it." Glancing quickly to my right, I saw that the monk had suddenly reappeared. He was standing in the air right next to me, and was falling at precisely the same rate of speed that I was. "Fly. Just do it," he said to me even more firmly. "What other choice do you have? Use your willpower. Do it now or you will die and never get to meet and help all the people that you are meant to." Listening to him speak, I somehow suddenly knew just what to do. By pushing down with my feelings, I gradually began to slow my descent. By pushing down harder with my feelings, I was able to stop myself in midair. And by pushing down as hard as I could, I slowly began to ascend. Using my feelings to propel and direct myself, I flew upward through the air on my snowboard, until I reached the safety of the cliff above. Then I stopped. "Now that wasn't so hard, was it?" I heard the same voice ask me. I looked around for the bald-headed monk, but he was nowhere in sight. His ability to rapidly appear and disappear, and to speak without being seen, was beginning to annoy me. "Don't worry about where I am," he said. "You will see me soon enough." And with his words still echoing in my mind, I was awakened, by the sun shining through the youth hostel windows onto my face, to my first morning in Nepal. After washing and dressing, I had a quick breakfast of hot tea and cold pan bread dipped in honey. Then I headed outside to explore Kathmandu. The narrow, early morning streets were already filled with people shopping for food and other goods. I walked happily through the crowds, listening to the sing-song sounds of the Nepalese shopkeepers selling their wares. As I strolled along the city streets, the pungent smells of saffron, cumin and coriander I had entirely forgotten about my dream, until I saw several bald-headed Buddhist monks, dressed in their brightly colored ochre robes, walking toward me on the street. Seeing them reawakened the memory of the levitating monk I had dreamt about the night before. As I watched the monks walking toward me, I had the crazy notion that if I were able to focus my will hard enough, as I had in my dream the previous night, I would be able to fly up into the sky and hover above their heads. I laughed silently at the absurdity of my thoughts, and at that exact moment the approaching monks grinned openly and widely at me. I couldn't help but wonder, as they strolled past me, if they had somehow read my thoughts telepathically, and if they were as amused by them as I was. After walking through the streets of the city for about an hour, I began to approach the outskirts of Kathmandu. It was there that I had my first real glimpse of the Himalayas. The giant, snow-covered mountains rose from the distant horizon and disappeared from sight into the white and grey clouds that constantly hovered above them. Daylight and the shadows cast by moving clouds played back and forth upon their glistening slopes. I stared at the Himalayas for what seemed like an endless time. Their effect upon me was immediate and magnetic. I knew right there and then that the time had come for me to surf the Himalayas. The Nepalese receptionist at the Kathmandu Youth Hostel arranged for me to get a ride up to the mountains with a local farmer, in the back of his yak-drawn cart. Sitting there on a pile of straw, next to my snowboard, I listened to the driver's non-stop comments without understanding a word he said. Every time we passed a temple or a large building, he raised his right arm and pointed to it. Then he smiled at me, and in an excited voice, said something in Nepali that I couldn't understand. In an attempt to be polite, I smiled back at him and nodded my head affirmatively, as if I understood what he had just said, as we bumped and bounced along the rock and gravel road together. After we had ridden in his cart together for several hours, the road turned sharply upward, and I began to get a closer look at the Himalayas. I was totally transfixed by their rough and jagged beauty. Staring at them from the back of the cart, I had a sudden experience of déjà vu. I clearly sensed that in some way, and at some other time, I had been in these majestic mountains before, even though this was the first time in my life I had ever visited the Himalayas. We gradually made our way up a high mountain pass. When we reached the crest of the pass, I motioned to the driver to stop and let me off. A small path wound its way skyward from that point to a section of the mountain higher than the road surfaced. To get to the top of the mountain, I would have to proceed the rest of the way on foot. After I had taken my snowboard and the rest of my gear out of his cart, I thanked the driver in English and waved. He smiled and waved back at me. Then he said something to me in Nepali as he pointed up to the top of the mountain. I thought I detected a tone of warning in his voice, but for all I knew he was wishing me good luck. Turning around and waving goodbye to me, he drove off in his cart, leaving me alone, in the late afternoon snow, halfway up my first Himalayan mountain. Strapping my board and day pack onto my back, I began the long, slow and arduous climb up the steep and rocky trail that led to the mountain's summit. Chapter 2, How I Met Master Thwap. After climbing steadily up the steep trail for more than 3 hours, I finally reached the mountain's summit. Unlike the mountains in the United States that I was used to snowboarding, the Himalayas had no chairlifts or rapid trams to ride up to the tops. Standing on the crest of my first Himalayan mountain, drenched in perspiration from my ascent, I looked down over the snow-covered slopes below me. As I gazed out over the distant horizon, I suddenly realized that I was on top of a mountain that was twice as high as any I had ever snowboarded before. I stood there and listened to the sound of the wind, hoping that the mountain I was on was not particularly prone to avalanches. I had brought the longer of my two snowboards with me that day. While slightly less maneuverable than my shortboard, the longboard was faster and better suited to deep powder. After removing my day pack from my back, I unzipped it and pulled out my snowboarding boots. And after slipping them on, I placed my hiking boots inside my day pack, zipped it back up and reshouldered it. Finally, I placed my goggles over my eyes, mounted my snowboard and prepared to snow surf down my first Himalayan peak. The ride down was fantastic. I shot through the deep powder like to slow down. As right then and there that I surfed my first Buddhist monk. He seemed to have come from nowhere. At first I thought I was dreaming again. But there, not 20 feet in front of my rapidly descending snowboard, stood a short, bald man in a saffron-colored robe. Fortunately for him, I wasn't moving very fast when I snowboarded him. Unfortunately for me, after we had both stopped rolling in the snow and risen to our feet, it was more than evident from the monk's expression that he was really disgruntled. I walked over to apologize to the bald-headed monk, and to see if he was all right. While he clearly wasn't very happy with having just been snowboarded, he otherwise seemed fine. I glanced at his face, and much to my surprise, I recognized him. He was the same monk I had seen in my dream the night before. I stared at him silently, not knowing what to say or how to say it. I suddenly wished that I had taken a crash course in Nepali just prior to hitting him. After several more moments had passed, I broke the uncomfortable silence that was rapidly settling in between us. Assuming he wouldn't understand a word I said to him, I apologized nonetheless in English to the short, bald-headed monk, who was still brushing snow from his robe. I felt an apology of some kind, even if it was in the wrong language, would be better than no apology at all. Judging from the intensity of the expression on his face, he seemed to be listening very seriously to what I was saying to him. After I finished my apology, his face seemed to relax, and he no longer looked quite as upset. I wanted to explain to him that I'd seen him in my dream, but in addition to my inability to speak Nepali, somehow it didn't seem like quite the right moment to strike up a casual conversation. Several more moments of silence passed, as we both stared at each other. Then the monk, whose face was still covered with flecks of snow from his recent close encounter with a snowboarding American, spoke to me, not in the sing-song Nepali that I would have expected from him, but in perfectly graceful, although slightly accented English. "Our meeting was fated, and your karma caused it to happen," he began. "An apology for what was inevitable is totally unnecessary. Also, as you can see for yourself, I am unhurt. You look like you took much more of a tumble than I did, young man. I saw you in a dream I had last night," I blurted out. "That was not a dream," he replied. "It was real." "What are you talking about?" I asked. "Oh, come, come, my young friend, of course it was. Get the board that you flew down from the mountain on and walk with me back to Kathmandu. We will talk as we walk. Come now, we must hurry along. The sun will soon be setting, and then it will be too cold out here even for one of Buddha's monks." As he spoke, I thought of the long walk that lay ahead of me back to the hostel in Kathmandu, and suddenly realized that I was extremely tired. As if he had been reading my mind, the monk said, "I am sure we will not have to walk too far along this road before someone who is driving to Kathmandu comes along and gives us a lift. There are certain advantages, my young friend, to being one of Buddha's monks." He smiled at me and proceeded to introduce himself. "My name is Master Fwap Samdup. I am the last master of the Raycourt's Fwa school of tantric mysticism and Buddhist enlightenment. You can call me Master Fwap if you like." After introducing himself, he quickly and gracefully bowed to me. He then asked me what my name was. I introduced myself to the aged monk, after which I bowed back to him, awkwardly and self-consciously. His eyes twinkled as he watched me, and I could tell he was secretly amused by the complete lack of savoir-faire that I exhibited in my bow to him. Exchanging my snowboarding boots for my hiking boots, I shouldered my day pack and strapped my longboard onto my back. Then the two of us walked down the remainder of the snow-covered mountain slope, until we reached the gravel road below. Chapter 3, The Road to Kathmandu. We walked down the rest of the slope without speaking. The only audible sound was the continuous crunching of my hiking boots on the frozen snow. When we finally reached the road, I had to sit down and rest for a few minutes. I was both physically and mentally exhausted from the altitude, the excitement of having just snowboarded my first Himalayan mountain, and the incredulity of walking down a mountain next to a short, bald-headed Buddhist monk, whom I had met the night before in a dream, and surfed today. While I was sitting on the snow-covered ground, trying as best I could to pull myself together, Master Fwap began to softly sing a Buddhist chant. The sound of his voice soothed me. After listening to him sing for a few minutes, I felt refreshed and relaxed. I stood up, and then Master Fwap and I began walking down the road to Kathmandu together. While I was walking along the road next to Master Fwap, I had the opportunity to examine him more closely. He was about 5 feet tall, very thin, and couldn't have weighed more than 125 pounds. From my 6'3" vantage point, I had an excellent view of his neatly shaved round head. His face, like that of so many Nepalese people, was gently wrinkled from a lifetime of exposure to bright sunlight and extreme high altitude. But despite the many small, fine lines of age, he didn't seem at all old. In fact, his skin had a healthy and youthful glow. I guessed that Master Fwap was about 70 years old. His eyes were hazel-colored, although they seemed to change hue according to his mood. When he smiled, which was quite frequently, he revealed a perfect set of pearly white teeth. It was his eyes that kept catching my attention as we walked. They sparkled with an inner power and intelligence I had never witnessed in anyone else before. Walking next to Master Fuap, I had the strange and haunting feeling that I had always known him. For some unknown reason, it didn't seem to be at all unusual or out of place for the two of us to be out walking together in the winter snow, down a Himalayan road, on a late January afternoon. I sensed that we would be bumping into each other soon, he laughed, although I must admit I didn't know that today would be the day. My own master, Fwaz Shastra Dup, foretold of our meeting many long years ago. He said that one day I would run into a tall Western youth on this very mountain. I must admit though, at the time, I didn't take his comments quite this literally. He said with a hearty laugh. If you don't mind, he continued, I will tell you a little bit about myself as we walk. Then tomorrow, if you like, you can come to the temple where I live and visit me. It is on the western side of Kathmandu, on the outskirts of town, in the foothills. As we walked along the road to Kathmandu, Master Fwap began to tell me about his life. He said that he had been born in a small village in eastern Tibet. As a child he had shown an early aptitude for Buddhism, and so, as was the custom in Tibet at that time, on his 10th birthday his parents admitted him to the local monastery to study Buddhist yoga and to become a monk. Master Fwap told me he had spent many happy years growing up in the monastery. The senior monks taught him the Buddhist scriptures, meditation, astrology and Tibetan medicine, while he practiced Buddhist debate and martial arts with some of the younger monks. Master Fwap said that although the senior monks who taught and resided in his monastery were very knowledgeable about meditation and Buddhist yoga, unfortunately none of them were enlightened. At the age of 19, when he had learned all he felt he could from the senior monks, he decided to leave the monastery and search for an enlightened Buddhist master of his own. Master Fwap explained to me that to become enlightened, it was necessary to first find and study with an enlightened Buddhist master. I knew that only a fully enlightened Buddhist yoga master who had the full power of enlightenment at his disposal, Master Fwap explained, would be able to show me how to attain enlightenment and reach nirvana in this very lifetime. In his search for a fully enlightened master of his own, the young Master Fwap traveled and roamed for many years throughout Tibet, Nepal, Bhutan, Sikkim, China and India. In his travels he had met many Buddhist yoga masters, some of whom could perform miracles. I asked Master Fwap if he would tell me about some of the miracles he had seen the Buddhist masters perform. He told me he had met Buddhist masters who could levitate, heal the sick, become invisible at will, fill the night sky with white and colored light, open interdimensional doorways, and do many other incredible things. He said the unusual powers these masters possessed that enabled them to perform these miracles were called siddhas. He explained that the masters he had met gained their siddha powers from many years of meditation upon their chakras. At that point I interrupted Master Fwap's narration, and asked him if he would explain to me what chakras were. He told me that chakras are mystical energy centers that exist within the human aura. He said every living being has an aura, a field of psychic energy that surrounds and protects its physical body from negative psychic energies. He explained that the aura is the body's psychic immune system. Master Fwap further explained that tremendous occult power resides in a person's chakras, and that siddha masters draw upon that power during their meditation practices, store it within themselves, and later use it to perform miracles. Master Fwap told me that, while he had been very impressed by the siddha masters he had met, by the powers they wielded and by the miracles that they could perform, he hadn't really felt that any of them were truly enlightened. I then asked Master Fwap, after first admitting to him that I had absolutely no idea what enlightenment was, or why anyone would want to seek it, how he could tell if a Buddhist master was really enlightened in the first place. Master Fwap responded that, in his opinion, there were two conditions that would indicate whether or not a Buddhist master was truly enlightened. The first condition was that the master's aura would turn a beautiful, bright, golden color when he meditated. Do you mean to say that you can actually see golden light surrounding an enlightened master's body, Master Fwap? Oh yes, most definitely. He said, as he nodded his head in affirmation. Almost anyone can see the golden light in an enlightened master's aura when the master meditates, unless, of course, the person is very blocked up psychically. Master Fuap elaborated, saying that sometimes you can see other colors in addition to gold in an enlightened master's aura, and at very special moments, you can simultaneously see many colors in a master's aura. He referred to this multicolored effect as a master's rainbow hue. Master Fuap went on to say that the second characteristic that would indicate whether or not a master was truly enlightened was his sense of humor. He remarked that an enlightened Buddhist master would always have a totally outrageous sense of humor, because life, when viewed through the eyes of enlightenment, was incredibly funny. This surprised me. I guess I had always imagined somehow that Buddhist masters would be very stoical. Master Fuap informed me that while there are indeed as many sides to enlightenment as there are ways to achieve it, the experience of enlightenment always imparts a light and playful sense to both the master's teachings and personality. Master Fuap went on to explain that sitting in front of an enlightened master while he is meditating is like being in the middle of an energy storm. At times, he said, your entire body tingles with ecstasy as you feel the waves of psychic energy that emanate from the master's aura touching your own body. After his brief discussion about enlightenment, Master Fuap resumed his story about his search for an enlightened Buddhist master of his own. He told me that in all of his travels throughout the East, he had never encountered a master who fulfilled both of the necessary qualifications for enlightenment. He also said that while he had met a few very funny masters in his travels, none of them had emanated waves of golden light when they meditated. I asked Master Fuap if he had studied with any of the Siddha masters he had met in his travels, and if so, had he learned how to do any miracles? To be honest, I was much more interested in hearing about the Siddha masters and the miracles they performed than I was in learning about emptiness and enlightenment. Master Fuap responded by saying that spiritual knowledge, which he called enlightened awareness, is of much greater importance than the ability to perform a few miracles. Spiritual knowledge is the experience of enlightenment, and requires an understanding of the innermost workings of the enlightenment cycle, Master Fuap began. Spiritual knowledge is the awareness of the eternal side of things, the eternal side of ourselves, of others, and of the worlds that exist both within and outside us. The only reality that exists for most people, Master Fuap continued, is the world that greets their physical eyes and other senses every day. They believe that this world, he said, moving his arm in a large, sweeping gesture that encompassed the entire valley we were walking through, is all there is to life. The world that you see around you appears to be physical. It is filled with mountains, snow, plants, animals and people. It is ruled by time and the laws that govern matter and energy. It is a world in which we experience pleasure and pain, loss and gain, birth and death, happiness and sorrow. Naturally, since most people are only aware of their physical natures and of the physical side of their lives, their happiness is extremely limited. When their physical lives are pleasant, when the events and circumstances in daily living turn out as they had wished or hoped, they will usually be happy for a short while. But when the events and circumstances in their lives don't turn out as they had hoped or wished, most often they experience a great deal of sorrow, unhappiness and pain. As I'm sure you know by now, based on your own experiences in life, most people aren't really very happy. Beyond their surface appearances, the smiles that they wear for the rest of the world to look at, most people are soul-sick. The vast majority of people who populate our planet live lives of quiet desperation that are all too often quite harsh and painful, lives in which events and circumstances usually don't turn out the way they had hoped or planned. Most human beings are completely out of touch with their spiritual nature, Master Fuap stated in a factual tone of voice, and with the inner dimensions that exist within themselves. They don't realize each person has a soul, an inner core of light and intelligence as vast as the 10,000 worlds, whose true nature is emptiness, ecstasy and happiness. But Master Fuap, I quickly interjected, lots of people know about the soul. They teach people about that in church. Yes, he replied. Some people do know they have a soul.